Okay, next matter up, docket number 84420, Sadowski versus Hollywood. Counselor, are we ready to go?
Yes, sir.
All right, did you want to reserve any time?
Yes.
Okay.
Good morning, and may it please support. My name is Wayne Klom on behalf of Barbara Sadowski in her official capacity as Secretary of State. The initiative process contained in Article 19 is self-executing, and the process also is something that the people have reserved to themselves. It is not a grant of power that they've given to the legislature, and it is not a grant of power that they've given to any specific entity. The power to both propose and to enact or reject initiative petitions is reserved to the people. Statutes which inhibit that power do not facilitate that power. And that is exactly what NRS 295.026 does when applied to the facts of this case. And specifically, when we talk about a right, we talk about the vesting of a right. And with these rights that these people have, that people have reserved to themselves, the issue is, when does that right vest with the people? When does the right vest to propose an initiative petition, and when does the right vest to vote on that initiative petition? But those rights are inherent in the people, right? And so the right has to vest as to a specific initiative petition. The jurisprudence of this court has been consistent that the right vests once that initiative petition is signed by the requisite number of voters, in this case 10%.
So, Mr. Klopp, are you here representing the people who signed the petitions?
No, I'm here representing the Secretary of State, who has an obligation and an oath, has taken an oath to uphold the Constitution. The duties of the Secretary of State, as enumerated in the Constitution, Article 19, are consistent with the rights reserved to the people. In other words, once a petition has been filed with the Secretary of State, she has certain obligations. Among those are verification of signatures along with the county clerks. She also then has to submit that proposed initiative, because once it's filed with the Secretary of State, it is proposed. She has to submit that to the legislature. That is a requirement of the Constitution. If the legislature adopts that initiative petition, it becomes law without a vote of the people. And that is the only way that once a petition is filed, that the legislature can avoid a vote.
Well, I think that your observation about the secretary's duties under the Constitution is an important question in this matter. But you're making an argument on behalf of those people who signed the petition. The petition also included a provision that allowed three people to withdraw it. So it would seem like when those signers signed the petition, they recognized that the petition could be withdrawn. Doesn't that undermine this particular portion of your argument?
I don't think so, Your Honor. That is in the law. That is not in the petition itself. The petition states, and the description of effect states, that this petition will become effective either if adopted by the legislature on X date and if enacted by the people on Y date. Mm-hmm. It does not include a statement that says, unless it's withdrawn. In fact, the withdrawal statute that allows withdrawal after initiative petition has been proposed introduces a new requirement, a new procedural hurdle for the people to exercise their rights to both propose and enact or reject.
So are you making the argument that the withdrawal statute as part of the statutory scheme is unconstitutional and in violation of Article 19?
I'm sorry, say that again, please.
Are you making the argument that the withdrawal statute is unconstitutional because it is in conflict with Article 19, and in particular the sections regarding what occurs when the legislature fails to enact the initiative?
Only as applied to petitions that have been proposed by the electorate. The withdrawal statute is appropriate for petitions where they have not been filed with the Secretary of State. And so somebody who files a defective petition, for example, or wants to amend their petition, can absolutely withdraw that petition. But as applied here, where it infringes upon the duties and obligations of the Secretary of State, and it infringes on the duties and obligations of the legislature, then yes, the application to this case would be unconstitutional.
So just to clarify, an otherwise valid initiative, securing the proper number of signatures that the Secretary of State has delivered to the legislature and on which the legislature chose not to act, sets in motion what the Constitution expects to happen next.
That is correct.
And so I repeat my question. Does that sequence, is that sequence interfered by state statute that allows for the withdrawal of the petition? And if so, is it unconstitutional?
Yes.
Why?
Because it interferes both with the obligations of the legislature, the obligations of the Secretary of State, as well as the rights reserved to the people to both propose and enact or reject those petitions at the polls. So,
how are the rights of the people impacted in a situation like this? Let me take a card from the case that we just heard, right, about what was the purpose of the initiative? The purpose was to increase taxes and fund education, correct?
Right.
Specific to what was laid out as what those taxes would be, but isn't that what the legislature then did on behalf of the people?
The legislature did enact a tax to fund education on a different entity. So the Constitution contemplates that this circumstance might occur, and I don't think that decision has been made, and there's a footnote in the briefing that talks about this. But if the legislature adopts a different measure on the same subject, both of those measures then go to the voters.
And that's pursuant to the constitutional mandate. I mean, that's the alternative that the Constitution spells out. If the legislature wants to reject it and propose something different, Article 19 says then both go on the ballot and the voters get to pick. Right?
That's correct. And the provision that gets the most votes then becomes law. That's in Article 19, Section 2, Subsection 3. And so, yes, this statute will interfere with that process. The process by which the legislature, the process that governs the legislative actions, they can enact, reject, do nothing, or they can adopt a different measure on the same subject. And whether or not that is this is not before this court, and was not briefed in this case.
But you're saying that the opportunity to withdraw and have the legislature adopt an alternative is not part of the scripted options that the Constitution affords.
That's correct.
So construing this withdrawal statute to permit the legislature, I mean, let's say the legislature gave an alternative. So Justice Herndon's hypothetical is, well, that's going to serve that. But if they wanted to do that, both needed to go forward to the voters.
That's correct.
Okay.
The statute also doesn't contemplate that just the legislature would negotiate a resolution. The statute allows withdrawal for any reason. So if a third party came in and said, hey, let's come up with a different solution to fund education in this instance. In another instance, it might be an initiative petition that says, hey, let's raise $1 million of taxpayer money to build a monument to name your favorite organization. Well, a third party could come in and say, hey, I'm going to donate that $1 million. That negates the purpose of your petition, even though it's been submitted to the legislature. And even though the right to vote on that now is with the people, go ahead and withdraw that. That's not how the process is written in the Constitution. It may not be the best process. There may be a better process, but it is the process that we have, and it is the process that the sovereign, the people, have put in the Constitution. And so the jurisprudence of this court, I think, is consistent with that interpretation. The statutes that the court has considered and upheld have not frustrated the purpose or the rights that have been reserved to the people. In other words, they don't frustrate the right to vote. They don't frustrate the right to propose. What the statutes do is they put additional pressure on the person or entity proposing an initiative petition. For example, There's a statute, the single subject, the description of effect. Those two statutes have been held to be constitutional because they facilitate the process. They allow voters to engage because it allows them to understand what is happening. It makes the process more simple, which is another key, I think, to this case, which is the Constitution is drafted to be understood by the voters. It's not necessarily drafted to be bandied about by legal minds, although that is certainly this court's jurisdiction. But the court should interpret this Constitution the way it is read by the voters. Other statutes which this court have upheld also place additional pressure on the entity proposing the initiative petition, not the rights reserved to the people, including an affidavit of the sponsor to verify signatures, a 60-day period for collecting signatures, whereas statutes which inhibit or frustrate the rights reserved to the people have been stricken by this court, including a statute that provided for adoption of a petition that was signed by 60% of the voters without a vote, regardless of whether or not 60% of the voters proposed it. The court still struck that statute because it had to go to a vote of the voters.
So Section 5 of Article 19 has one sentence. The provisions of this article are self-executing, which by itself has some significance. But the legislature may provide by law for procedures to facilitate the operation thereof. Your argument, at least on the point I was asking you about, is that the withdrawal statute does the opposite. It does not facilitate, but rather it inhibits.
That's correct.
Especially whereas here, I appreciate your clarification, the withdrawal committee was not named in the petition, but was rather listed when this was filed with the Secretary of State. Is that what you're saying?
Repeat that last part again.
I understood you to say that the withdrawal committee was named in the document filed with the Secretary of State, but not in the petition itself.
That's correct.
Okay.
Unless there are further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Okay, thank you.
Your Honors, good morning. May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices Bradley Schrager from Sears Hollywood and Belknap, and with me is Mr. Henry Ida, Mr. Poulsenberg, and I will go for most of the time. We're only talking about reserving time when you're splitting it, but when I sit down, Mr. Henry Ida will get up. How about that? Justice Kadish, I'm going to get to your question, which sort of strikes me as at the heart of some of the Secretary's interpretation, which is when you're going to be talking about the people, pretty good to understand which people, who are the people. But I first want to begin with Justice Hardesty's probing into whether or not the Secretary is saying that the law is unconstitutional. Clearly, that is what we're dealing with here. So what I want to talk about for a second is that this came to you in a very weird and unnatural way. You know, a separation of powers has been a subject that's been sort of simmering on the public stovetop recently. And this is obliquely part of that, because by her conduct, the Secretary essentially unilaterally declared 295.026 to be unconstitutional and unenforceable. It turned this case into a challenge to that statute by a defendant, Secretary, and a defense of the statute by a plaintiff, my clients, who were only trying to avail themselves of the clear language of 295.026. But it arrived here in essentially totally the wrong way. Had a private citizen or an entity challenged the constitutionality of any statute, there would have been all the things you have to do when you do that. You have to notify the Attorney General. There would be discussion in the court below regarding the level of scrutiny. The burden would be established and discussed below. All those things would have been done. And because this is an election case, it probably would have gone through some version of what's known as the Anderson verdict test, in which the state's interest is balanced against the burden upon the voters or the electorate. None of that happened here. So I think it's important to sort of realize that. I don't think it mattered in the end to the district court's decision, because many of these discussions were subsumed in the way the court approached the question. But what if my client didn't have the means to bring the case, or didn't have the ability to defend this appeal? We would have been at the mercy of a constitutional interpretation by an executive officer who was not charged with doing that, as we've said a million times, going back to Marbury versus Madison. That happens here. But there was no declaratory relief offered. There was no case sought to clear this up on the secretary's part. That was left to my client. Fair enough. As I said, I don't think it really mattered in the end, but it may one day. Now, Nevada Constitution, Article 19, Section 5, empowers the legislature to provide by law for procedures to facilitate the operation of the initiative process. So the entirety of this question, in this case, comes down to whether or not 295.026 achieves that. Is it within the legislature's power to make the decisions it made to enact the possibility of withdrawal of petition statutes? And even in that, there's a little strangeness. But let's talk about facilitation, what that is. Facilitation doesn't necessarily mean make it easier. This court has passed upon plenty of statutes that obviously don't make it easier for proponents. Single subject rule is a restriction. Doesn't make it easier. The description of a fact, that very valuable real estate policed by this court, doesn't make it easier. The petition districts, that obviously makes it harder to get an initial petition through. So it doesn't have to make it easier. Facilitate must mean something else. It means to either clarify or provide notice or get the process writ large holistically to a point where the various interests that we talked about just a little bit ago, the various interests, both of the people, the electorate, the proponents, and the opponents, are respected. 295.026, the withdrawal statute, actually expands the rights of initiative proponents and makes clear the process and deadline for an important aspect of the procedure, the potential for withdrawal. And I want to be clear, it is not necessarily that the secretary has ever objected to the fact of withdrawal or the possibility of withdrawal. In fact, the 2017 version of the amendment, which had no deadline within it, the secretary was a primary sponsor of, was a mover of. It's the 2021 amendments of 295.026 which set the actual withdrawal deadlines. Those are the ones the secretary finds objectionable with her constitutional argument. But those amendments facilitate and clarify the initial process for proponents like my clients. Because right now, from start to finish, my clients know the dates upon which they can submit the petition. They know the dates their signatures are due. They know the number of signatures, not just overall, but in the various petition districts. Now they also know the dates certain by which they would have to withdraw their petition. The legislature, in its wisdom, looked at the entirety of the process and said, this is a valuable facilitation. This will help the process. And there's many, many policy reasons. You can choose one, you can choose none of them. You can simply say the power of the legislature existed and was properly executed. But for example, when an initial petition is submitted to the legislature, under the Constitution, it has 40 days in which to act, accept, reject, do not, right? Legislature meets roughly the same time every 2 years. That's early February. So we're talking about the middle of March. But from the middle of March, the general election at which it would be considered, if it goes to the ballot, would be, what's that, roughly 18 months, 19 months, 20 months? Awful lot of things can happen in the intervening 20 months, and the legislature is entitled to take that into consideration. We could have a recession. We could have, I don't know, a worldwide plague. Right. Your problems that are raised by the initiative petition could be solved one way or the other. What the legislature said was we are going to recognize that interregnum as something you can still withdraw the petition. I think that's a pretty smart decision. You don't have to agree with that. You just have to agree that it is within their power.
Is that consistent, though, with Article 19 and the scripting it gives for the time deadlines? Like, you collect the signatures, you validate the signatures, they have to be delivered to the legislature within some set number of days before it convenes, then it's the first order of business, then there's 40 days. There's a whole scripted scenario that goes through. And you're interpreting this withdrawal statute very broadly to say, doesn't matter that you're engaged to the legislative process, it's been delivered. So it kind of obviates the tight scripting that goes on in subsection 3 with the governor proposing some alternative and the legislature coming forward with it and that being put forward to voters as competing provisions.
Yeah.
It strikes me it's inconsistent. And that's what's troubling me about your argument.
I understand that. I think that the sort of, I think the way to understand it is that the argument that's been put forward by the secretary has this sort of reified notion of the people having control or interest in it, and that the custody of the thing shifts, right? The power over the
But that's thing. The history of initiative. I mean, the progressive era in the early 1900s was to do that, right?
Not that specific. It was to allow for direct democracy. Generally, the actual machinery of the network of direct democracy is, I think, up for debate and for regulation by the legislature. So I think the scripting you're talking about is not necessarily as tight as perhaps you've interpreted.
Well, maybe it is. So let me just ask this question, because I really am interested in this. And if a person were to do an opinion, it seems to me one has an obligation to address this point. Unlike a description of effect, unlike a single subject provision in a statute, the withdrawal statute seems to run directly contrary to the sentence within Section 3 that reads, if the statute or amendment to a statute is rejected by the legislature, or if no action is taken thereon within 40 days, in this case, both apply. The Secretary of State shall submit the question of approval or disapproval of such statute or amendment to a statute to a vote of the voters at the next succeeding general election. There is nothing about withdrawal, and it seems to run exactly contrary to what the withdrawal statute contemplates. If you're writing an opinion, Mr. Schrader.
Yeah. I don't think it was exactly contrary. Oh. There is some contrariness to it. Mm-hmm. But I think the way to read 19 in this report is that the secretary shall put on the ballot a ballot petition initiative petition, which is in fact complies with all these other things. There's certainly nothing enumerated in the Constitution that talks about petition districts, or at least the county portion of that, which was struck down many years ago. There's nothing in there about a single subject. There's nothing in there about a description of impact. There's nothing in there, technically, about all the regulations that the Secretary of State has enacted, pursuant to the legislature's rights to facilitate. The ability to withdraw doesn't affect anyone else's rights. This finally gets to Justice Kadish's question, which is, who are the people? This reified notion of the people who have rights. Well, my clients are still part of the people. They're the ones that conceived of the petition. They're the ones that carried the initial petition. They're the ones that defended it in two courts. And they're the ones that brought it forward. They have rights as well. And I don't think that the constitutional provision is inconsistent with, at any point up until the 90 days prior to the election, with the ability to withdraw that.
And Mr. Schrager, I think it was felt a little muddy earlier. To be clear, the petition that was signed indicated three individuals who could withdraw that petition.
There is a notice of circulation, of intent to circulate, that is filed with the petition. That is correct. If there's no other question, I do want to leave time for my colleague.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
I mean, I can pose it to Mr. Henriot as well, but he's shaking his head. No, he doesn't want to answer. But it seems to me, you know, as the court tries to harmonize things all the time, right, that if Article 19's provisions are self-executing and the legislature has the right to enact statutes to facilitate this process, that it's pretty easy to harmonize that you put viable petitions forward on the ballot, not ones that were withdrawn. On the other hand, what I struggle harmonizing with is the position of the secretary, which seems to impact, say, in the earlier case, if we're to find that petition initiative invalid in some fashion under what she's putting forth today, that would still have to go on the ballot.
That's right.
So well, what, I mean.
It would be a joint. I
But I think I take your point, which is that the interaction of all these provisions have to be harmonized. They have to be harmonized in a way that in the end respects the rights, right? What I think that the legislature did here, because I think that the secretary's interpretation, with all due respect, winds up with differing interpretations for the three different kinds of initiatives. There is no moment, maybe after circulation in 19-2, that is tantamount to this in the Constitution, where the custody or the power over the initiative changes. There's absolutely no moment like that regarding referendum. What the legislature said was, we're going to pick 90 days before the election as the date for all three of them, so everybody knows. So in some sense, whether it's been enjoined or not, which I would probably still be the province of the judiciary, there is now a date certain harmonized for the entirety of the initiative process that still falls within the legislature's ability under 19.5 to facilitate the process. In fact, this, like the single subject rule, like the description of effect, like the petition district, this is a regulation facilitating that directs conduct of the proponents. And that's really what the initiative procedure is all about. So I'm going to turn it up for me today.
Mr. Henriot, I'm going to give you 2 minutes on top of what's left and add 2 minutes to your opposing colleague's time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it. And I'd just like to emphasize a point I want to make sure isn't lost. Appellants say that they are interested in preserving and protecting the rights of the people in this important progressive era of reform. I respect that, and I don't question the good faith of the argument. But I think importantly, their interpretation does not enhance the rights of the people in the initiative process. Rather, construing the constitutional provision in order to prohibit withdrawal eviscerates the versatility of that rule. So it works in two important ways, but the purpose generally is to prompt action. Right? It comes out of that progressive era when the frustration with the legislature is that they would sit on their hands because legislators in both parties, people feared were owned by monopolies and trusts, and so they wouldn't act. So there's the ability of the people in the initiative process to put forward their own law. And if the legislature won't adopt it, then the people get to vote on it.
Mr. Henry, can I interrupt your argument? Because I'd like to pin this down tighter, and I'm hoping counsel on the other side will address this point. My understanding is that at Joint Appendix 30 and 56, the initiative petitions listed Hollywood, and Belknap as among the three individuals permitted to withdraw or amend each initiative petition. If that's so, then under our jurisprudence that talks about valid or invalid petitions, initiative petitions, we have recognized that they can be withdrawn if they're void or if they're in conflict with some other provision in the election laws. But in this instance, I'm not sure we need to reach the constitutional question if the petition itself says that these people have the right to withdraw it, apparently, no matter what, how many people signed it. So I'm trying to determine whether it's necessary to even get into this constitutional conflict if the petition that people signed represented that there was a committee that could withdraw it. Now, what's the facts?
I think Your Honor is absolutely correct. It is not in conflict. And I think what's really important to understand is that when the signers are agreeing to give the kill switch to these proponents, they are authorizing them both to make sure that this gets on the ballot.
Well,
and
for your side, is this cite to the record correct? Is that what the record shows? Or do you know? And if not, maybe you can provide to the clerk your view of where in the record the it is clear that the petition identifies a withdrawal committee and who makes it up.
Okay, so I want to and what their powers check are. With the specifics of sure. that question, but I believe the answer is at page 30 of the joint appendix. But I will triple check that.
Great, thank you.
The idea is to prompt action. And if the proponents, speaking on behalf of the people, don't pull that kill switch, then it goes in the ordinary course all the way to the Secretary of State and on the ballot. But they also can prompt action by getting the legislatures to do their job. And here, that's exactly what they were able to do with this. The legislators took a look at this, knew that the specter of it would create taxes and against targets in the economy that they felt couldn't bear it very easily. So we saw what is very rare in our age, a supermajority of a bipartisan majority agreeing to increase revenue, but targeted against an area of the economy that they felt could bear it without risking jobs or without risking market demand. It's not unlike the role that trials play in the judicial system. Trials are the default way of resolving disputes, but we can also settle cases. There's also alternative dispute resolution. Trial dates settle cases. Why do we say trial dates settle cases? Because it is that looming specter with the accompanying uncertainty, cost, risk that prompts people to talk and to negotiate. And that wouldn't work if the court could not vacate the trial. It wouldn't work if that were unavoidable. The reason that this compromise was possible, this historic compromise in the legislature, was because the proponents were able to withdraw the specter of those voting questions.
Well, the interesting part about that argument, Mr. Henrion, is, and maybe that's good government, but that's not a choice that's contained within Article 19.
I think notions of good government are important to the construction of the Constitution, especially in the face of any ambiguity. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm going to jump right to your question, Justice Hardesty. The page that you referred to in the appendix is JA30, and that is the notice of intent to circulate statewide initiative or referendum petition, and that's for the first initiative petition. There's a similar one for the second that names three people who are authorized to withdraw. That gets filed with the Secretary of State. That does not get circulated with the petition, which is found on JA21. And that does not reference any withdrawal or any persons authorized to withdraw.
Well, just for my notes here, what's JA21? What is that document you're looking
at? That is the initiative petition statewide measure as amended for S-01-2020.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
And then this description of effect is on the following page, JA22. That likewise does not contain the withdrawal language or the identification of those individuals. For that petition, the other petition is located both the initiative and the description of effect is at JA 49 and 50 for the S-02-2020. And I would submit that even if, so the voters would not have seen that unless they went to the Secretary of State and said, hey, I'd like to see the notice of intent to circulate that petition. But even if they had seen it, I still submit that the statute would be unconstitutional in this case because it conflicts with the express language of the constitutional duties of the legislature and the Secretary of State. I don't disagree with Mr. Schrager that this case is unique and unusual in both its form and its procedure, but I did want to read the oath of office taken by constitutional officers, at least part of it. This is found in NRS 282.020. I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will support, protect, and defend the Constitution and government of the United States and the Constitution and government of the state of Nevada against all enemies, whether foreign or domestic, and that I will bear true faith, allegiance, and loyalty to the same. And that's really why the Secretary of State has taken this position. The Constitution includes a mandatory obligation for her to place initiative petitions on the ballot. She is the gatekeeper of the rights reserved to the people to enact or reject initiative petitions that have been proposed. She is also the gatekeeper for the ability of the citizens to propose initiative petitions by collectively 10% of the voters in this case have to sign initiative petition, and then that has to be filed with the Secretary of State. That is how it is proposed. And I appreciate and respect the fact that there are rights and duties and obligations that the statutes and that the Constitution grant to a petition sponsor. That's the person or entity that drafts it and that circulates it. And that's a big duty, a big obligation. But the jurisprudence of this court, dating back to almost the time that the provision, the initiative petition was adopted in 1912, reflect the reality that the right to propose is inviolate and the right to vote on a petition is inviolate. In State versus Scott, there was a group of petitioners that tried to withdraw their names from a petition that had been circulated, that had been filed and therefore proposed with the secretary, or with, I guess that would have been the county clerk. The court did not allow those petitioners to withdraw their names from the petition and thereby defeat the jurisdiction. Because the court concluded, once it is filed, this jurisdiction is passed on. The proponent, the ability of the people to propose an initiative petition has passed and is now the province of the people to enact or reject that initiative petition. And that's the power that they have reserved to themselves expressing the Constitution. If there are no further questions, we'll submit.
Okay, thank you for the briefing and the arguments. This matter will stand submitted. The court will stand in recess until the next call of the court. Thank you.